Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to drive giving. QBAC doesn't just measure alumni engagement scores. It uses academic research in cognitive science and positive psychology to actually increase an alum's willingness to give. Quantitative data, such as capacity, gets a prospect into your pipeline, but qualitative data, such as impact stories, gets a prospect through your pipeline. QBAC's AI-driven system uncovers actionable insights and automatically delivers them to major gift officers for use in cultivation. Learn how to raise more money with less by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. I would also like to tell you about Responsive's training. If you're looking to align your entire team around a shared understanding of effective fundraising, let's talk about Responsive's four frameworks. If your culture doesn't feel right, before you begin any significant planning, launch a capital campaign, let's ensure that everyone is on the same page. How about inviting us to be on site with your board, leadership team, volunteers, and staff for your next planning event? If you prefer a virtual event, that'll work too. Let's get your team thinking critically and more carefully about the road ahead. Shoot me an email. I will also put some information in the show notes. Hi, Sarah. Delighted to have you back on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. It is a wet, rainy Tuesday morning, and you and I think, are both enjoying in our respective places. We're enjoying our first cup of coffee. You've been on the show before. Delighted to have you back. Before we start our conversation, how about introducing yourself to our listeners?
Sure. Well, Jason, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm Sarah Livieri. I'm a number one international best-selling author, former executive director. Before I got to be executive director, I certainly sat in many seats and wore many hats. I'm also an author, now a two-time author, and I'm creator of The Impact Method. And I spend most of my time these days teaching nonprofits The Impact Method so they can run them better, more efficiently, make a bigger impact without getting overwhelmed or burning out, and hopefully even getting some more time back in their day.
So, Sarah, last time when we were on the show, I don't think we talked so much about your writing. So tell me about these two books you've written.
Sure. They're kind of different and not directly nonprofit related. The first one I co-authored, it's with AAPC, the Autism Asperger Publishing Company, and it is a model for creating lesson plans for kids on the spectrum or with other special needs that integrates the therapeutic component directly into the academic plan. So very much kind of same type of thinking as I do now, but in a different context. And then more recently, I was in a book called The One Thing Every Mompreneur Needs to Know about setting goals, which is something I love teaching nonprofits to do. But in this case, I was doing it for other mompreneurs.
Oh, I like that. So we're so my wife has been right. She's I don't know that she'll ever consider herself an entrepreneur or a mompreneur, but she's going to start writing. And we've just recently paid for her to have our designer is creating her branding and websites and that sort of stuff. And it's going to probably push my wife, Erica, out of the box. So what kind of advice would you give her for a mom who up to this point has raised four children? That's like been her identity. It's been her entire world. What would you say to her?
Yeah. Well, I would tell her and all the other moms out there and entrepreneurs, it was, I think I had started my third business before I finally called myself an entrepreneur. So, and I think that's especially hard for women to be ready to own that title. So I would just tell her to own it, love it. Owning a business is kind of like being a mom, but instead of only being pregnant and having to care for an infant for like, you know, 9, 12 months, it goes on for years. You get to like be solely responsible for this fledgling thing you've birthed. And then eventually it starts to grow up and stand on its own legs. So you have everything you need being a mom to be a great entrepreneur and just own it and love it.
Oh, yeah, you certainly do. Yeah, that sort of that adaptability and that really high tolerance level for BS. And
you know, I think, you know, this nonprofits have an easier time with this, but it's true for all business owners. The ones who really succeed, they just don't accept failure as a negative or as a stopping point. They fail, they make mistakes just like everybody else. They just see them as pivot points to change and learn and grow from instead of obstacles that are getting in their way.
Fascinating. Well, Sarah, I was delighted to have you back because when we talked the first time, I thought, okay, Sarah's somebody who could really keep me going, and it sounded like I could keep you going. So we agreed to get you back on the schedule. And what are we going to talk about this morning?
Yeah, well, I'd love to talk about kind of your core understanding of who your nonprofit is, because I think having a really clear understanding of who you are as though your nonprofit is a person is really critical to getting all the rest of your fundraising and many other activities right. It's like an amplifier. If you get that right, everything you're doing with fundraising is going to be like many times more effective. And if you have it wrong, even if you're doing all the quote right things regarding to fundraising, it's just not going to work that well.
That sounds deep. So go a little, I'm going to sip on my coffee a little more and let you warm up this idea, but I'll get in there. I'll get in there. Trust me.
Well, one way to think about it is the B word, branding, which I'm just going to put it out there. But all I want to say really about the B word is that people have defined branding in so many different ways. It's almost meaningless. So I like to talk about very specifically the heart of your brand, which is how you identify who you are. And, you know, we do this kind of naturally without really thinking about it as human beings. You know, we have all sorts of self-help books and we think about how we want to present ourselves in the world and what defines us. But as organizations who are literally, it's called an organization, right? Because it is a group of people who are organized to somehow work together, row the boat in all the same direction. You have to get a little more specific about it and you have to be able to really put it in writing and you have to get good at what, you know, the words you use to communicate it so that that whole group of people can be on the same page. And frankly, because you're getting a group of people on the same page, it has to be a little more dumbed down. It has to be more simple than like a human personality.
Okay. So see, I knew you'd get me going here. So I sort of came on the scene and started really I started establishing a platform for myself, published a book, created this podcast, those sorts of things. And a lot of people who sort of know who I am would sort of say that, you know, it's been about 2.5 years, right? And even in that 2.5 years, my brand or our brand at Responsive has sort of evolved and it's kind of been a journey. And even some people who've remarked about sort of the way we're positioning ourselves now would sort of say, you know, it's a pretty cool brand. You seem to have sort of figured things out, but they seem to be okay with the evolution. And so I guess my question is do nonprofits afford themselves the freedom to sort of be these evolving brands? Cause I think about a lot of the organizations that I've worked with over the years and interacted with and actually been on the payroll with some of them, you know, their brand or their identity sort of stayed same. They try to be the same organization they were like 40 years ago. And it's like, okay, I think you've changed. I think you've evolved. I think you've grown up a little bit, right?
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, I'm going to answer your question, but let me ask you a question first.
Okay.
As your brand was evolving, was the core of who you are as a person, did that change significantly or did that stay relatively the same?
No, I totally was changing too. I mean, the experience itself was, I was sort of going through my own professional journey and realizing, so like, just to totally pull back the curtain on my, so 2.5 years ago, I would have embraced the notion of sort of being very contrarian. And I was working with our branding company and she said to me, she said, how about less contrarian and just be more expressive? Contrarian is very combative. And I said, okay, I can handle that. And I can sort of own that. And I can also sort of see where the contrarianness about me sometimes gets me in trouble. And so, I mean, it was like a self. So the answer to your question is yes, I was going through my own sort of self-awareness journey.
Yeah. So I think you've just said kind of the key, the ding, 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 self-awareness, right?
Yeah.
Because I doubt that the thing that was driving that contrarian output is really, I think that's still within you, I'm going to guess. You've just changed the way you express that core thing. And so I think to get a grip on branding, you have to really understand that there are two sides. One is understanding who you are at the core, that piece that never changes or doesn't change much. Yeah. And then also understanding how you express that into the world. And how you express that into the world, you have to be able to change that. One, because you're never going to get it right the first time. Two, because it needs to change depending on who you're talking to. And three, even if all those things are perfect, the world changes. And so as context changes, how you communicate needs to change. You know, someone who's very social and used to communicate only on the phone in the 50s and they were talking away and then they got the phone with a long, long cord. And then maybe in the 80s, they got their first wireless phone. They're not talking on the phone anymore. They're on FaceTime or, chatting or using social media. So the context of how we communicate with our friends has changed. But the fact that we enjoy communicating with them has not. Does that make sense?
It does. Sit on that word context a little. I don't think the word, and I just put something out last week in some things I'm writing, and I'm even researching this notion of context. I don't know that we talk about context very much in what we might call nonprofit or fundraising branding or something. I don't even know if we do enough of us even know what that means.
Yeah. And I have a colleague who's a very top level marketer. She does not specialize in nonprofits. She does big, big, big marketing. And she says context is the thing, right?
Right,
so
right.
You're absolutely right. We're not talking about it. And you absolutely should. When you think about, if you're asking yourself questions, well, what should I say in this email? Or, you know, should I send an email or should I focus my attention on social media? What's the difference between my Facebook post and my Instagram post? The answer to all of those questions lies in context. It's like the key to unlock how we communicate. And it gets tricky in the digital space because in the face-to-face world, we intuit the complexities of our context pretty easily.
Yes.
But
totally.
When you're digitally communicating, your output of communication and the receiving of the communication are separated. And all of a sudden, it's like we all struggle with grasping that context.
Yeah, I've been reading, his name's Hall, I can't remember his first name, but this guy's writing in like the 1950s and 60s about the context being sort of this language that we all use. And what he's doing is he's comparing, at the time, he's an anthropologist and he's studying American culture against the Japanese. And the Japanese remain to be very high context and we understand ourselves. And for example, most people in the United Kingdom are very, what he called low context. Mm. But the interesting thing, about Hall's research is that if you now apply a lot of this thinking to sort of very present day, for example, they're saying that some of the research I'm happening upon is that, like, millennials, for example, are very high context because of the way in which they're able to communicate in these very quick. I mean, they're sort of that first young generation that learned how to have this smartphone in their hand and communicate in symbols and stuff in very quickly and create that context sort of around the way that they were communicating, but it wasn't explicit words, which is what low context communication relies on. It's just like explicit, like say what you mean and don't say anything else and da 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 da.
Right.
So it's very fascinating. And I think in some ways, Sarah, I think it's going to get us in trouble in fundraising because for so long, fundraising has been here in America, especially, it has been this low context. It's just been about what could be expressed in word, you know, what I can say versus and what can be articulated on paper and in email or something like that. And like your friend, if context is becoming so critically important, we've got to learn how to communicate that way. And I just don't know if a lot of us know how to do that.
Yeah, so it is important, and the trick to surviving, to use the language you've been reading about, like high context communication, is to really pull out the core of yourself and then the communication of that core of yourself. So I like if we use words that were already out there, I'd say the core of yourself is your brand and the expression of who you are is your branding, which usually then leads to marketing. But the branding is how you communicate who you are, because how you communicate is going to change and it is going to be affected by context. But if you don't anchor that first in who you are, the core of yourself, the things that don't change, and those are not going to be represented visually necessarily, it's not information for the outside world. It's not communication really outside of your core team. It's understanding what you believe in, how you choose to exist in the world, your choices around right and wrong, and your core purpose, right? As we are mission-driven nonprofits, when I was in graduate school, that was the phrase everybody was using, mission-driven. Now we use the word impact, right? There's a perfect example. It's the same thing. Context has changed. We now say impact. We used to say mission-driven. The core understanding of why we exist as nonprofits has not changed. So I like to focus on three things to drive that core purpose. And I can go over them if you want.
Yeah, let's do it.
The first is, of course, you have to have a really clear mission and it needs to be outcome focused. I haven't actually met a nonprofit whose core intent of their mission had changed pretty much ever. But the way they express it usually needs a lot of help. Sometimes the missions are so long and full of jargon, they've lost all their meaning, but the team still knows what the mission is, even when the mission doesn't say what it is itself. So I like to do missions. I kind of like break it up into three columns, you know, one from column A, one from column B, and one from column C. So column A is you got to know who it is you're impacting. Is it a specific demographic? Is it people with a specific issue? You know, is it, what is it? Is it, could not be people, right? It could be something environmentally related. And then the next thing, you know, is what is the outcome? What is the place you're trying to get those people to? Are you trying to change their mindset? Are you trying to change their behavior? Are you trying to change their circumstance? Same if it was the environment. And then finally, are there any like specific constraints around your mission? I love adding constraints to nonprofit missions because it keeps them from going squirrely. Like, you know, only do it in a certain area? Do you only achieve your results using a certain method or do you avoid specific methods? Those three things, who you're trying to impact, what's the outcome you're trying to achieve for them? And are there any specific rules about how you do that or where you do that? makes for a really great, clear mission. So you can decide when someone says, is that mission aligned? Your mission should be written in a way that you can say yes or no, not sure.
Yeah, I had that. It's funny you say that about constraints. I use the word limits sometimes. Limits and constraints. I remember talking to some of my students at the college about this back in the spring. I know this was last fall on a particular case study that one of our students was looking at. And the constraint was essentially that this organization that, you know, had these very change the world sort of goals. This was a humanitarian organization. But essentially they had, and I believe it was in their mission statement, because from the first slide as this young man is presenting this, I remember it coming out really quickly. They were working in two countries and they were totally okay with just these two countries, and their whole identity was these two countries. And so they had, and I remember thinking, and I remember us talking about the fact that so many of these, especially a humanitarian organization that's trying to work with people, you know, people in poverty and third world type stuff, that it would be so easy for an organization like this, to try to do all this stuff and try to be all these different things to every country on the planet and wouldn't get anywhere.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I think that's what, you know, you think about this, the smallest sort of startup organization, nonprofit organization, oftentimes you're sitting there and you're talking to them. I've done some consulting with these types of groups. A lot of times it was private schools. And they absolutely think that they're going to take on the world and their enrollment's going to like go out the roof, that, you know, and they're not okay with just sort of seeing the constraints, the limits. They're not sort of giving themselves boundaries and saying, let's just do this really, really well.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so, so important to be specific like that. And it helps you, I believe it helps you make better solutions. It helps your programming be better in the long run. So that's really critical. And I find, yeah, you know, for those people listening, if you just write out what you're doing in those three columns, you should pretty easily be able to form one or two sentences. They should be memorable that capture the concepts of those three things. And then you will have an awesome mission that people can remember. And kind of interestingly, for those who know some for-profit marketing space, when I guide people through writing mission statements in this way, they often sound a lot like UVPs, unique value propositions, that for-profits often create as part of their marketing process. And I think because UVPs serve basically, they stand in place of missions for many for-profit organizations.
Is there a way you could look at like those three columns that you just sort of, let's say I'm a board member and right now is a really tough time and certain things just aren't sort of clicking and money's tight and COVID and, you know, Black Lives Matter and the November election and, you know, all this stuff sort of contextually sort of and we do this completely unrelated thing, whatever we do in the world. I'm thinking about identity crisis. Like how would a board member know that like we've just got a complete identity crisis? We are just trying to be like all the wrong things. We don't even know who we are. And
yeah.
How could they sort of listen to what you and I are talking about today and say that's it? That's the key indicator before they actually have the nerve to sort of confront their fellow peer board members and say, "Hey, man, we got some issues here."
That's a good question. You know, two approaches. One is, you know, if you don't have your mission statement memorized, that's probably a red flag right there. Because it's probably not your memorization skills. You know, when I read a mission statement, if I read the first few lines and then I'm like, blah, 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 you at least have a mission statement problem. Ask the question. Otherwise, another approach I'd say is, it's always worth improving and revising and revisiting your identity. And if you've written it in a way, when we get it right with nonprofits, everybody in the room goes, yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
So if you're at the point where everyone's going, yeah, that's it, awesome. If you're not there, then you need work. And not to knock on the process of bringing in a consultant to help you, but what I find is the process of getting it really right means, like, typically clients using the impact method, they're reviewing their language and modifying it, and usually takes about a year of looking at it every 2 months. So after doing it six times over a year with the team, not just the board, but actually your team who are running your nonprofit are going to be able to generate the language more easily than you are as a board member. Then you'll see that after usually about a year, the language stops changing at all. And then, you know, you're kind of there, at least for a while. And so, you know, just, I would say, assume that you probably need work in this area, and go from there. And don't worry about how broken it is, and just keep plugging away at it, and don't expect to get it right after the first pass at it.
I mean, would you expect, okay, so again, going sort of looking at everything that's sort of in the headlines and the social unrest and the political division and the polarization in our society right now, would you expect organizations to know better who they are, or would you be expecting, like, right now to be that time where they're where it feels like a moment of crisis? Because I feel like with everything that's sort of in the news lately, in the way that people are sort of trying to posture themselves, or this language of being very performative and sort of saying that this represents who we are and we're going to fight this fight and that kind of stuff, how does an organization sort of remain true to kind of stick with where we were at the beginning of this? How does an organization stay true to who they were if it's not sort of the issue of the day?
That is a fantastic question. So there's two answers. One is the other two pieces. I said there were three pieces to kind of make it up.
Okay.
Part of the brand. Good. So those other two pieces are really going to help you. And what I like to build out for people, or kind of enveloping, you can't see me, but I'm wrapping my hands around, because what should envelop that mission is a core belief. Or sometimes there are two core beliefs. It's something that your organization believes it's true. And if for some reason it was proven not to be true, your mission would become irrelevant. So for example, I used to work in the autism space, and there were really two core beliefs dominating the autism space. One group of nonprofits who believe that autism is a disease that can and should be cured, and another group who believe that autism is a different way of thinking that comes with both positive and negative challenges, and people with autism need to be supported so that it is a net positive, not a net negative experience to be alive and on the spectrum. So if someday it were proven that autism could be cured, the other camp would just, their missions would become irrelevant. And if the opposite happened, if someday it was proven that autism actually had tons of benefits and it's not a disease, and actually curing it would be a bad thing, if eliminating it would be a bad thing, then the kind of autism cure camp mission statements would mostly become irrelevant. So understanding what that core belief is that drives your mission is really important, because even though your mission isn't going to change a lot, it will change a little, but it's really unlikely that that core belief, which is super, is like a super, super anchor. You're probably not changing that belief. If your belief becomes untrue, then you're probably dissolving your organization and becoming something else.
And is that one of those constraints in your mind that, I mean, because that's very different than Target and Walmart, for example, or Coca-Cola. You know, these for-profit Coca-Cola knows that they can sell a bottle of Coke for forever. But once a mission, for example, has been accomplished, isn't that part of creating that constraint? And I've heard that advice before, and I've always thought, well, that's really wise, but that's also very hard for an organization that thinks that it's going to exist forever. I think I've heard it put, the idea of, you know, ask the question, what's going to actually put you out of business? And in, like in the case of autism, if autism was cured and we figured it all out, that would sort of make you irrelevant now. But that's a different, you know, that's a different quote unquote business model than I think most of us are accustomed to thinking about, because we're so accustomed to sort of looking at the private sector and thinking about, okay, you know, we want to sell bottles of Coca-Cola for the rest of our, you know, existence, and there'll always be a need for another bottle of Coca-Cola.
Sure. Well, I think, you know, I've definitely spent a lot of time. I think about nonprofit scenarios all the time. And I've spent a lot of time thinking about that very issue. It's kind of like, I remember learning about ecology when I was in high school and learning that all ponds are destined to fill themselves in and become no longer ponds. And it's the same with nonprofits, right? If you really do it well, you may solve your mission and game over on the one hand. Although I wouldn't spend too much time worrying about that, because I think most nonprofits have a mission that represents a goal that is so highly unlikely to solve completely, to even achieve. I like to call them your mission impossible, that you're probably not at risk for that happening. But on the other hand, while you're in the process of working to achieve your mission, hopefully you are creating an incredible organization that is building a ton of assets and processes and relationships. And that stuff is still really valuable. So if you were to achieve your mission, you can now pick a new mission, or you can turn all your assets over to a nonprofit or that needs them. And so it's not like it's all for nothing. You've created a mechanism for changing the world while you are trying to achieve your mission, if you've done it well. And that piece doesn't lose its value.
All right. So how do we sort of put a ribbon on this? What's the rest of who we are? Because I'm
sure. Well, there's the third piece, and you may have heard of core values, and I'm not going to say get core values, because I have tried using core values. I found them most unhelpful because they are a mix of beliefs and choices. And so you'll notice I put beliefs squarely. You only need one or two as an organization, and it's what drives your mission. And then people can believe whatever they want who come to your organization, as long as they buy into your core belief. But where you do need everybody to align is a set of guiding principles. They're the rules of the road for your nonprofit. And these are not, you may expand on them as context changes, but they're probably not going to change that much over time. These are, I like to think of it as Robin Hood, right? Robin Hood says, Robin Hood and his band says, we steal from the rich to give to the poor. And that you might be a Robin Hood organization, and you might have made choices like that. Or you might be a totally not in the Robin Hood camp. You might be like, we don't steal no matter what, we'll find another way to help the poor. So you have to have a set. It's really helpful, I should say, to have a set of guiding principles that say, this is just how we're going to conduct ourselves in the world. These are not your, they're not your mission. They're not what you're trying to achieve, but they're how you choose to be. And that's really relevant right now. And when we talk about what's happening in the world right now, and between COVID and racial tensions and an increased awareness, we're in a change moment with race as well as many other things because of COVID. It's people who don't really know what their guiding principles are flailing right now, and the cracks are being revealed. And those people who do know what their guiding principles are, this is probably the most helpful thing when it comes to your choices around branding and marketing and fundraising, is lean on those guiding principles to really limit how you're going to make your choices. Are you going to release a statement about how you feel about police brutality against people of color? The answer to that question, if you have guiding principles, is there. And if you don't have a good answer to that question, you're probably missing a written down set of guiding principles.
Oh, I like that. Okay. Do you have this on like a, like something I can attach for all of our listeners that have just heard you sort of walk through, like in a PDF or something? Because I'd love to put this in the show notes. And
sure, I have most of it in a PDF. I'll see what I can get for it together for you, so you can put it in the show notes. Because I do have it. I do have a couple worksheets related to this, so I'd be happy to put that together for everybody.
Well, Sarah, every time we talk, this is number two, and I enjoy the conversation. You and I seem to keep each other going. We need to get on the stage or some platform together in person as soon as COVID affords us the opportunity to do that. If somebody's listening to our conversation, the other thing is you come at it at a different angle, and I appreciate that too. You know, the content that I'm sort of pushing out there. And so we have very, very aligned, but sort of different audiences, and we're speaking sort of very similar messages. So I appreciate that. If somebody's listening today and they want to reach out to you, how would you suggest that they do that?
Sure. Probably the best way is to go to Pivot Ground. That's the name of my company, pivotground.com. And if you click on the apply for a call button, you can have a free consultation with me one-on-one. Also, I'd encourage you to sign up. I do a free 15-minute online training almost every week, and you can sign up for those on the website, or you can find past recordings on YouTube. Just search for Pivot Ground, and we will come up.
That's pretty cool. Okay. All right, Sarah. Well, it has certainly been a pleasure. You're always welcome back. Thank you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.